Hi, and welcome to the first quarterly conference call of the Friedberg Mercantile Group. I'm David Rothberg, and with me, as always, is portfolio manager of the Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Asset Allocation Fund, Al Friedberg. Al, how are you this morning?
Good morning. Fine.
Good. We're recording this on a sunny day in Toronto, one of the few sunny days we've had so far this spring, and so we're very grateful for it.
For a change.
For a change, indeed. Al, I want to start by recounting a lovely evening that we had last week. I'd like listeners to know that last week we had a dinner for the entire staff of Friedberg Mercantile Group. Pretty well everyone attended, 35 of us in the Windsor Arms. And the dinner was for many reasons, one of them being to celebrate what's been a fabulous success of both the funds. The Global Macro Hedge Fund, for those of you who don't know, is up over 185% over the past year. It's been compounding at 50% over the past 3 years and at 33% over the past 5 years. And the Asset Allocation Fund, which is, of course, a much less leveraged fund, not leveraged at all, in fact, has done on a comparative basis equally well. At the dinner, because the dinner was spread out over one long table in order to break the ice, Albert stood up and introduced everyone on the staff by recounting how many years they had worked at Friedberg. And I think I haven't got the number in front of me. Al, maybe you can correct me, but if I recall, the average length of time that a person had worked at Friedberg Mercantile Group was somewhere in the neighborhood of between 20 and 25 years. That was the average.
26, 26 years.
26 years. So on one hand, this, I think, is something to really celebrate. On the other hand, and I'm
Most
speaking to
wait, most important of all, you were the longest employee.
I was
50 years. 50 years.
50 years, 50 years. Of that, like I'm sure the entire staff, we have much to be thankful and proud of. But I'm thinking from an investor's point of view, there must be in knowing that some sense of worry that in fact we've been around so long that there's a risk factor involved. And the reason I wanted to begin today's call by mentioning that is that every quarter, we solicit questions from investors and from subscribers to our quarterly report. And this quarter, virtually all the questions are about risk. They are about risk. And of course, it's because of the great success. People are wanting to protect their money and they're worried about this. So I thought that we'd start the call today, rather than talking about individual positions, talking about how you yourself are positioning yourself. And how your investing style has evolved, and the way you're approaching markets now, and the way you've incorporated other people on the staff to be able to work in concert with you.
All right, I hardly know how to start, but we take a very aggressive position. I think we have spoken about that. By the way, can you hear me?
Yes, can hear you well.
Yes, we take a very aggressive position because we are very concentrated, meaning we have very few positions. And for the most part, we try to concentrate in no more than three. At the most four positions, but three being larger. And they and we try to watch them very closely. Try to watch them very closely. We go contrary to the old proverb that says diversify. We say no, put all your eggs in one basket and watch the basket well. That's the old Gerald Loeb's maxim. And to watch it well is an hourly effort. It's sometimes a minute by minute effort. But rather than trying to anticipate some of these markets, which move in very dramatic fashion, we take the position that we rather ride them once we're in there, and react quickly if they begin to deviate from our expectations. So concentration, and leverage, our leverage usually capped somewhere between 2.5 and 3 times capital, gives us a little bit of a gives us some power. And our constant sight is on the S&P. We believe that the best benchmark we can use is the S&P, S&P 500. And of course, being leveraged, we should be able to do better. Of course, mathematically, if we were long 3 times the S&P, we would always do better, but only do better if the market kept going up. So it's not a one-way street. And, 3 times leverage can also make you lose money very quickly, as we found out in 2020 with the onset of COVID.
Yeah, I'll just take the opportunity to interrupt by saying that, of course, one of the great advantages of being invested in the fund is not just that we've enjoyed great returns, but those returns are almost entirely alpha-based returns. They gain very little power from the market. Where you're they're not correlated to the market, in other words.
That's
So
right.
you have, in addition to those returns, you have some protection in the event of some
That's right.
collapse in the
We,
market.
yeah, we, exactly. We're not positioned as 3 times S&P. We our position, our positions are varied, and they, and like you say, they're not necessarily correlated. So that's what we've tried to do. To be responsive is a difficult job, because you have to sort of decide. And I'm going to give an example. You have to decide whether that is the end of the move, the end of the trend, or is just a reaction. A good example, maybe, for example, the position that we own in oil. We're long oil via Brent futures. From time to time, there's a scare, like quote unquote, a scare, that some peace agreement is in the making. And that, let's say the Straits of Hormuz would be opened or reopened quickly, and so the oil price would react very, very quickly, and they drop. So, first of all, it's probably impossible to react immediately to those news, because by the time, I think even before the news come out, the market is already reacting. Somebody or somebody's know. Some of this information beforehand. So it's almost impossible to react immediately, but one could react within a few hours. And we have had to decide each time whether that is just a reaction and that's a correction in of nervous holders who are selling, or this is a change in trend. So far, we have decided that this is just corrections. And so we are still in a position, but those are the assessments that we have to make very quickly every day, and they keep us on our toes. They keep us on our toes. We, you know, it's important to do that when you have such high leverage. For example, our long position in oil is maybe about 60% equal to capital. So that's a fairly large position. Anyway, that I think that sort of describes a little bit of the kinds of things that we do, right, David?
Yeah, it does. I think so. I think just to go back historically, it used to be that you were your leverage. It's evolved over time. Your leverage used to be much higher. It was at one time it was as high as 7 times capital, 7 times the NA, seven times the assets, and you were managing risk then by assuming hedge positions. Now you no longer are hedged. You are highly concentrated. You're leveraged at not 7 times, but still 3 times, or if not 3 times, slightly under 3 times. That's your goal. These are all high risk methods, and so really, what you're saying is you manage risk through acuity. Acuity. You're trying to be very sharp and very quick. So how do you do that? How do how do you incorporate the staff to help you with that? Describe your team, if you could.
Right. Well, as I say, it's difficult to put it into a formula. I don't think there is any formula for it. And I would think that it's a matter of interpreting news. It's a matter of interpreting the psychology of the market, the way the media reports the news, the way the market, the way, call it, the pundits are describing what's happening. As you know, we are mostly contrarians, so we like to see the kind of common opinions that are surround the markets, and I think that's for us an indicator of trouble. It doesn't always work. For example, an example was the peak in gold recorded recently at around $5,400. I was blindsided when that was happening, because I was following certain indicators trying to tell me whether the opinion was a crowded opinion, whether a lot of the retail public was in this market, and if a lot of the retail people were in the markets, it would say that we could have a very substantial reaction. I wasn't seeing that, and one of the reasons I wasn't seeing that, and this is a phenomenon of this globalization of markets, is that a lot of the action in precious metals was taking place in Asia, and it only came to my attention later that these ETFs in China and Russia, in China and India, had accumulated something in the order of $100 billion worth of gold. I mean, it was a fairly large amount of gold. Maybe my memory's is playing some games as to, I think the number was very large. The number was very, very large. And I was not aware of it. I have to say, I was not aware of it. And it's also the speed at which the accumulation of units took place. So there we fail. We fail to see that the market was crowded, very crowded. And so when it came down very quickly. We did manage to reduce the position, which was very large at the time. I think it was something in the order of 2.2 or 2.3 times capital. So that's a large position and a very leveraged position. But we reduced very quickly. We went below 1.5, and then below 1.25 times capital, at which point I was relatively at ease. Because I didn't see any more further downside, or much further downside. So those are the kinds of things that we have to look at, which a lot of it has to do with psychology. A lot of it has to do with psychology. What is the sentiment around? Is the sentiment one-sided? Are people very confident that the price of gold, or very confident that tech stocks would go up, or are there still doubts in the market? Is the market climbing a wall of worry, as they say, or the market is climbing a wall of euphoria, and it's not climbing; it's just riding euphoria. And those are judgments that we have to make. But they're sometimes irrespective of what the fundamental picture would show. It's psychology that's very important at the turning points in these markets.
And how do you make those determinations? I know that you depend on technical analysis, on looking at charts and open interest. Is it in commodities in particular? Does this is this what largely informs your views about sentiment?
About sentiment, yes, sentiment. Sentiment is, again, as I say, is reading about com is reading comments, is reading headlines, is reading or listening to comments on media. And sometimes some of it has to do with what you call chart behavior. But chart behavior doesn't really give you sentiment. What it will tell you is if markets are maybe very overbought, but it won't give you readings on sentiment. So it's the turning points that are important. And at the same time, we have to keep an eye on the fundamentals, which is, for example, one of the interesting things about, for example, I'm going to take gold as an example. Our case was predicated a number of years ago on the fact that central banks became a major factor in buying gold, and that the market was not paying attention to it. And they were buying large amounts of gold every month, and it was a lot of different central banks doing that. So that has persisted. In fact, since 2022 has increased a little bit even on a quarterly basis. I believe we're buying something like 240 tons a quarter. It's a lot of gold being bought by central banks. A number of them, quite a few. And at the same time, some central banks are liquidating, but net net, there's still increases in purchases. But that is the fundamental factor. If, for example, we would know or we would see that that levels off, and by the way, it will need to level off at some point, and I explain why. But if we begin to see it levels off, our fundamental background already is changing. And if the market is still advancing rapidly or still moving up, it may make us reduce a position or even eliminate a position. That could be a factor. But they are fundamental factors that we have to look at every day. They don't change very quickly, but they are changes. We saw, for example, India became a major factor in gold, and that they dropped the consumption, the imports of gold dropped substantially in the last few months because of a tax that the Indian government has imposed on imports. And the amount of gold that has not been imported to India is something like 60 tons a month. It's a lot of gold. So that's a counterweight, and that's a fundamental counterweight. We don't think that will last very long, but it's a fundamental counterweight. So, and I just mentioned before that there is a moment in which the purchases of gold will level off. The central bank purchases will level off because they will reach very high percentages of central bank reserves. Already, some countries have seen their gold allocation go up to 50, 60, or 70%, given what they bought and the price increase. So obviously, those central banks will stop buying. But there are other banks still today that are not what we may call well invested in gold. One of them is the Central Bank of China, which is very important. And I believe that the Central Bank of China only has an allocation of about 10%, 9, 10%. So there's room for them to go up. And we spoke about this years ago. We thought that that would go to maybe 30, 40%. That would have a major impact on the market. Anyway, it is important for us to keep an eye constantly on the fundamentals, and on the fundamentals that got us involved in the first place. What made us be interested in the first place?
When you talk about fundamentals, you're talking about gathering information from various sources. I know that you're a voluminous reader. Is there, and I but I don't know the answer to this. So even after 50 years, is there a particular source of information that you depend on more than others?
No, not really. The usual media, which is, the financial newspapers, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, those are the newspapers, Bloomberg, Reuters, some banks issue some very interesting reports, economic reports, ISI that we use, Nancy Lazar writes a very good report. David Rosenberg writes a very good report, an economic report. Those are the main, I would say those are the main reports. There was a time that we used to read a lot of the IMF and World Bank reports. Over time, I found them useless. I really found them useless. They very vague and not sharp. You know, they've lost their sharpness, and so I don't think there's anything there. And often it's not the report itself, but particular events that happen that you know that you can draw some implications from them. And those are important. But you have to be reading always to see that. And your eye has to catch it because there is thousands of pieces of information that come out every day. And most of it is noise, just pure noise.
You have a team of five guys who sit at your trading desk, and I know that while they generally have more or less specific tasks, they are generalists, and they are supplying you with information. What types of information are they giving you on a regular basis?
Right. So one of them is also a co-manager. He manages a small portion of the fund. It's supposed to be managing it in a more conservative fashion, but basically using the same ideas. And but other than that, the team itself is involved in execution. They're very good at that, in finding how much can be bought or how much can be sold or over how long can it be done. News that come out, they quickly transmit and discuss. So, and ideas are discussed generally too. And also there is this risk meetings that we have to with a group to assess where we are from a risk point of view. You know, they're not easy. They're not easy because again, there are no rules. But there is general assessments as to whether we may be too exposed or not too exposed to particular events, or whether the positions that we have are so highly correlated that we are much more exposed than we think we are. Over time, I've lost some interest in the idea of correlation because you know, correlation seems to me to be something that happens after the fact. You know, things are correlated. You only know they're correlated after the fact they're correlated. Ab initio, you can't really always make a case for these correlations. Yes, silver and gold are ab initio, they're correlated. Precious metals are correlated. But even there, there was a substantial difference between the way they performed. So I don't rely anymore on correlations, and I accept the fact that we could be fully in one, quote unquote, one position, one theme. It could happen that we're in one theme, even though we are in three, but there could be one because of the internal correlation that happened to be taking place at the time.
During crises, exactly.
And so I accept the fact that that's what it is, and that's why I think that leverage and capital leverage is the last resort. I mean, had we been leveraged 7-1 or 8-1, and position became completely correlated or 80% correlated, you know, we would be wiped out in a day, or in an hour. So I think that. You know, that area of 2.5 to 3 is for us a good cap. It says you might be very highly correlated. You're not aware of it. You don't know yet, but these markets are correlated. You'll find out later. And okay, if I do, at least I know that it's not 8-1, but it's like 2.5-1, our leverage.
We are going to talk a little bit more about the portfolio. We've covered gold, but there are other issues to address. But before we get there, one last question of a more general sort. I'm the oldest employee at 50 years, which means that you've been there longer than I have. and the fund has returned 185% over the past year. And the fund is, you're the largest investor in the fund. The fund is over $1 billion and you're the largest investor in the fund by miles and miles. So the question, the obvious question is why? Why do you keep doing it? What's the pleasure of it?
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure.
It is an incredible challenge, and it's a lot of fun to be challenged like that every day. You wake up in the morning and you're challenged already. You know, something happened overnight, and so I find that it's very challenging, and I find it very exciting. And I have to say that I find it exciting even when we lose money, and that's strange, but. I used to have a client that used to say to me, a good client used to say to me years ago, I love losing money with you. and the truth is that I actually don't mind it. And I always find it humbling in some sense. You know, it's like I gain an enormous amount. It's funny, I gain an enormous amount of respect for markets, the collective wisdom of markets. But I've also gained an idea that they're not perfect. And I can try to exploit that. There are times where the market is not aware of certain things or not paying enough attention. It will eventually do that, but temporarily it doesn't. The attention is diverted. They got some funny things going on. They're talking about, I don't know, the King of England coming to New York or to Washington, and that's important thing. It's happening, but there are things that are happening that are not always digested by the market immediately,
Well, the efficient market hypothesis has largely been disproven. If it were not so, there'd be no room for people like us.
I think it is weakly efficient. But even being weakly efficient, it is remarkable, the wisdom that it has. Just remarkable.
Let's turn a little bit to the portfolio. You've done something that is extremely uncharacteristic. When the internet first began, we were encouraged, these fantastic stocks. No, you could not be seduced to being a buyer of Amazon, to being a buyer of Microsoft, to being a buyer of Apple. You could not do it. And by and large, you've been a reluctant buyer of stocks, largely speaking, broadly speaking, over the course of your career. Suddenly now, you're a buyer of stocks and of tech stocks in particular. What happened to you? Where did you go off?
I think that in the days of the internet, I was still looking at, in a very rational way, I was looking at the long-term picture. I was saying, you know, I was trying to assess whether companies selling at 50 times sales have an upside. And it's clear that if you look at it over a 5-year period or 10-year period, you know that you're not going to make any return if it's selling at 50 times sales. It's unlikely, absolutely unlikely that you'll make any return. You probably lose money buying those kind of companies. And that's what was happening. I was looking at it long term. And even a lot of the decisions I made on buying was always very long term without paying that much attention to timing, because I thought it was inevitable. And I thought it was going to come, and I can wait for it, but it will happen. It will happen. I learned that, and I think that's a nice thing about being in the market so long. You learn always new things. And I learned that there's nothing inevitable. Nothing is inevitable. That markets adjust and adapt, and nothing is really inevitable. And it's not a good thing. It doesn't produce good results to trade on those ideas for long-term ideas, unless I can see a catalyst, or unless I can see something that will get the market out of that inertia, for example. But I think over time, I said that I will not anymore try to trade on the basis of great ideas that will take place sometime in the future. I needed to know when and how. And so I became much more of a convert to momentum trading, in a way. I think that's what you might call it today, momentum trading, which is, you know, you look at something, you say, you know what, this thing either has a catalyst, a 3 month catalyst, or 2-3 months, and I know it's going to happen the next 2-3 months, or it's already happening, and I am now riding the wave. And that, had I used that in during the late 90s in the internet boom, I probably would have ridden some of those markets up. And the question is, would I have been able to get out on time? Right. You know, that's what we're doing now. That's what we do now. We are riding some of these markets. We have more confidence in some of them. I mean, the truth is that the excesses today, I don't think are as bad as the excesses were in the late 90s. Many of these companies make money, and they make a lot of money, good money. They are selling expensively, but there is still some justification for buying them, and the momentum is there, the power is there. You can see the power of the move by the way they trade, the way they act, the way they move above their let's say their moving averages, and they distance themselves very quickly. So there's a lot of power behind some of these. And I think you can ride them, and you can ride the momentum. And then you say to yourself, well, I'm not going to get out of the top. That's clear. That's absolutely clear. But if I get out 15 or 20% off the highs, I'm still going to be a winner because I wrote those things, and I could have made maybe 100, maybe 200, maybe 300, maybe 500%. So I'm going to give up some money when I want to get out. But I prefer that than being too patient, looking at it long term and saying something like this, I'm not going to buy this because, you know, it's just too expensive, or I'm going to buy this because I know that something will happen that will make it go up. But I don't know when. And even though I think it's inevitable, I don't know when that will happen. And waiting too long is a great opportunity cost. Not only is it an opportunity cost, I've said that it's also a psychological cost. You know, I'm sitting there holding positions. They're not doing anything. The rest of the market is doing something. There are things happening. And I'm just holding something that's not going anywhere. It maybe even cost me money. The carry may be a negative, right? So I think that is the basic difference. More attention to the short term and to momentum, even though the same fundamental picture is being assessed and maybe in the same way.
It's not dissimilar to the rationale behind prediction markets, Polymarket and Kalshi, in that a prediction is not that an event. One of the things that defines what a prediction is it's not merely that an event will occur, but it must occur by a certain date. One has to be conscious of time. So, yeah, you're in concert with that thinking. So the portfolios of the global macro and the asset allocation fund are allocated largely to gold. Still, you have this long position in tech stocks, in the main tech stocks. And when we're talking about tech stocks, we're talking about chip makers and companies involved in the infrastructure of.
Well, it's basically four stocks, you know, Apple and Google and AMD and Texas Instruments, just four stocks.
Four stocks. What else is there? There's a third piece to the chair.
There's a position, a long position in oil, which I've talked about before.
Right,
And there's a very small, I would say almost immaterial position in well, it's material, but it's small because the market is small in cocoa, a long position. There's basically okay. three positions.
Okay.
In our average leverage is somewhere between 2.5 and 3. Now it's just under 2.5 probably.
Okay, so given what you said about being a catalyst and not thinking so long-term, it's sort of less relevant than it might have been if we'd had this conversation several years ago. But nonetheless, I can't resist but asking you for a broad view, because I know you always have one. I think the common view is that the market on one hand is challenged by the war, and on the other hand is being supported by AI, largely by the CapEx that sits behind AI. And there's a contest. The contest is being felt by investors. The contest is being felt by the Fed. They don't know whether to raise rates or whether to lower rates. What's your view? Or do you have one?
Well, the first thing is that the market seems to be, it has been pointed out, and I think today even a headline in the Financial Times. Yes, it is record low number of stocks driving Wall Street bounce raises fragility fears. And the article says that, you know, the market has been driven up by a small group of stocks, and the majority of stocks have not done anything, have not done well, or have not done anything. But I think that is more a reflection of the actual economy. The economy itself has become less broad, has become narrower. Right. The big money makers are these big companies, these AI companies and AI-related companies, they're the big money makers. Incredible profits, huge capital expenditures. And so you can't blame the market. Basically, the market is replicating what is happening in the real economy. So having said that, I think we have to be careful because, you know, the sentiment is getting warmer. It is warmer. It's getting a little hotter. You know, this idea is starting to, even though there was skepticism about this, now it's beginning to be more accepted. So we have to be careful from a technical point of view, or maybe from a psychological point of view. But other than that, the economy itself, and I'm kind of surprised that today we saw labor figures that indicate that despite dramatic layoffs in some companies because of AI, presumably because of AI, unemployment remained at 4.3. New jobs were created, higher than estimated. It's true, there's a few weaknesses there, like the average work week is a little bit lower. But generally speaking, we haven't yet seen what some of people have been worried about, which is there could be some massive layoffs and we could have a very high rate of unemployment because of AI. It could happen. I don't know. I don't have an opinion. And I think the Fed is actually facing this problem. The Fed is not really sure whether, on one hand, whether oil will generate by sort of spreading or leaking through the economy create a higher rate of inflation than they wanted. But at the same time, they worried about potentially rising unemployment. So if I was the Fed, I would say I do nothing. I actually do nothing and wait. And if I don't see money supply rising quickly, which is not happening, money supply is rising at less than 5% per annum, I would say that we are probably adequate rate of interest, that the 10-year at 4.4 is at a good level, at a level that's neither too high nor too low. I would do nothing so far. So it's a difficult position to be in. And when you are in that kind of position, I think you're best off not to do anything. Now, some people might say, well, isn't the level of speculation enough of an indicator that there is too much money, there's too much liquidity? I'm not so sure. I think that you could have a lot of speculation even while money and credit was not rising quickly. We are facing a transformative moment in some way with AI, and it's a boom that's based on real things, real changes. So I don't think that the Fed should be doing anything at the moment.
Al, thank you for your time, and let me end today's call with the admonishment to keep it up, man. 185% over the past. Keep it up. Keep it up.
Okay. Thank you, David. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Al. Bye
Yeah.
bye.
Bye-bye.